This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Jonathan Hochberg. Jonathan, it's good to have you on the show this morning.
Thank you for having me back, Eric.
You know, when we did the show before, we did it with your kids, right? Yeah, that was a great deal of fun. This is going to be a slightly different show.
It was a long time ago, too.
this is I'm in my third year of almost. I'm going to wrap up my third year in end of May. So, it's been quite a run, and it's been through people like yourself and others who've helped to train me to get me started on radio, because I had never touched a board prior to taking this show on, and admittedly I had maybe 2 hours or 3 hours of training before I was turned loose by myself on a studio on Sunday morning, which I do anxiety and fear, but I generally push through them. So.
Well, you've come a long way. The station has come a long way, and I love your show.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Well, thank you, and thank you for helping to be part of a large team, literally scores of people who are the rudder of this community, what's becoming a community institution in the best sense.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jonathan Hochberg, the question we begin with is, who are you? How are we going to start this conversation? What do we need to know to start that conversation?
Well, I am small town born and big city raised. I'm a son and a brother and a husband and a father.
Uh-huh.
I describe myself politically as a libertarian socialist. I describe myself spiritually as a... apathetic agnostic. And I'm a computer programmer by trade and a musician and filmmaker or videographer by hobby.
Wow. And where do you go in your life when you're looking, how do you frame the wholeness of that picture? That is a beautifully complex mosaic. What's the personal quality? What's the value, or what are the what's the short list of values that animate how you live?
Oh gosh. Actually, that's really easy. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, that's really the sum of it.
Right, and just by knowing you a little bit, we can actually play with that a little bit, as we played with that on this show another time. There's the golden rule and there's the platinum rule, and a lot of times our default in this culture is the golden rule, because that's the rhetoric we know. But the rhetoric that we don't know is the platinum rule, which is you do unto others as they would be done unto, and you ask to be done unto as you would in some sense be able to take it.
All right.
So you which is a modification. It's a mild. This is it.
And I don't buy that, frankly, because I think that there are broken people who would have things done to them which are not how they should be treated.
Exactly. And that's why we need the tension of the two, because the golden rule is self-referential. All of ethics is what I say it is. And that's why the tension between the two, there are broken people on both sides of the golden
Fair enough.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So that's why it's we launched into
sure.
Yeah. No. And I'm assuming we're going to hear a little bit about your where you were born and where you were raised.
Sure.
But you live now in a small city.
I live in a very small in a village. I live in Dryden, which is the a little bedroom community in between Cortland and Ithaca.
Right.
And it doesn't really have. It has a very modest economy of its own, but a lot of houses. Dryden is actually one of the largest municipal land masses in New York State, but it only has about 10,000 people in it. As such, we share a school district with a bunch of smaller places, so we have pretty high taxes.
Yes.
But it's a nice place to live.
It is. Yeah, and it's part of the MSA, which is Ithaca.
Yes.
And would include Ithaca and Schuyler if we actually did things according to the rules, but right. basically it's Ithaca at this
yes.
point.
Sure.
And it is a bedroom community and has been for probably 60 years.
Yeah.
Or maybe even longer.
Mm-hmm.
When the time when it was a self-sustaining kind of farming and small manufacturing community
sure.
was gone by World War II.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I moved there about 17 years ago.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And it's interesting because initially when people were looking for places to move to outside of Ithaca, they looked to Trumansburg.
Mm.
And then they looked to Dryden.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and now they're looking more towards Newfield.
Sure.
And it's just this is how people ping around. Yeah, and if you want really country stuff, you go to Danby, Caroline,
right.
or Enfield.
Sure.
So, right. Anyway, okay. So what did you bring musically? Where do you want to start musically?
Well, actually, so I did bring a pretty eclectic bunch of stuff, but with one exception, it's all from my formative years as in terms of when I started to listen to music of my own.
Mm-hmm. When you made the choices.
Yeah, exactly. I said I was big city raised. I spent 35 years living in New York City and had a lot of friends who were middle class.
Mm-hmm.
I was the son of two professors, and so I was not upper class, but I was definitely, you know, raised in the ivory towers.
Middle class with elite aspirations.
Well, I don't even know that they were necessarily elite aspirations, but they were definitely elite intellectualism.
Yeah, that's kind of what I meant.
Right.
Yeah, but yeah. You nailed it.
Yeah. Yep. And so I was raised with not a silver spoon, but a sense of
a silver OED
self, yeah, that's exactly a sense of self awareness and educational elitism.
Right.
That at the beginning I didn't realize was not commonplace.
Right.
And then I went to Stuyvesant High School, which is a special education, or not a special education, but rather a specialized high school.
It's an elite high school, one of a handful.
Yeah, in the New York City School District. And back then, it was a lot more egalitarian than it is now.
Oh, really? Okay.
And so I got into high school and I was immediately in the company of people from all walks of life, from mm-hmm, all mm-hmm, over the mm-hmm. city, and even some who came secretively from outside the city because the school was so
they found
after.
A way to get in with an address in the city.
Exactly. Yeah. And so this first song is off of the breakout album of one of my favorite poet, singer, songwriters, which I have loved his music from before this album was recorded, but this is the one that put him on the national scene, and this is Bruce Springsteen's Thunder Road.
Okie doke, here we go.
Like a vision, she dances across the porch as the radio plays. Roy Orbison singing for the lonely. Hey, that's me and I want you only. Don't turn me home again. I just can't face myself alone again. Don't run back inside, darling. You know just what I'm here for. So you're scared and you're thinking that summer praying in vain.
Bruce Springsteen and Thunder Road, and our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Jonathan Hochberg. So Jonathan, you've already started answering the question, you know, what were some of the experiences that shaped you and the child of academics and also the student at Stuyvesant High School. I didn't realize that it was more egalitarian, but it does make sense now that you're telling me the story. I'm thinking back, it's become part of that elite, and Townsend Harris was originally the elite
right.
school, and they've all become a little more like that
yes.
as they've created a pecking order in the city's system.
Mm-hmm.
But what about, you know, what about your growing up? What about your young adulthood has really kind of continued to echo or create a context for your life as you live in Dryden?
Well, I think I have to start a little bit before that. Okay.
As most of us do. Maybe a few generations before
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no. Well, not so much. Maybe a little bit. To put things very briefly, my mother was an aspiring dancer in her youth, which never played out. And while I was... my sisters and I were born in Ithaca.
Mm-hmm.
When I was six, my father taught at Cornell. When I was six, mm-hmm. my father decided that he really wanted to raise his kids in New York City, where he had grown up, because he wanted us to get that cosmopolitan
sure.
Exposure. And so he applied for and received a one-year position at Columbia University, and we moved to New York. And then after that, he got a four-year position, he got tenure at NYU, he taught there, and we lived in Greenwich Village for 4 years. And that was
in the middle of the 60s.
Yeah, exactly. That was from 1965 to 1969.
Uh-huh.
So it was right in the middle of it. And then he took a permanent position at Columbia again. We moved uptown, and that's where I basically lived until I moved out of the house. But the reason why I brought up the dancing is because when my older sister, who was 2 years older than me, turned 8 years old, my mother took her down to the School of American Ballet and had her try out, and she got in. And in fact, she went on to go all the way through, and she went to Hunter College High School.
Uh-huh.
And she went on and could have become part of the core of the New York City Ballet. But decided that she had this dream one night that she walked into the dressing room and all that her peers were talking about were ballet shoes. And so she quit the dance and went to Harvard. Well, went to Radcliffe at that point.
Right.
Ended up being a lawyer.
Uh-huh.
But 2 years later, when I turned eight, I was watching what she was doing, and it looked like great fun, because the children who are in the School of American Ballet appear on the main stage at the New York State Theater, now the unnamed Brothers Theater, that they got to appear in these shows, and I thought this was just great. And so at the age of eight, I auditioned, and even though I was not particularly graceful. They were desperate for boys.
Right.
And so they took me in. And that year I got to be on the stage of the New York State Theater in the Nutcracker. And then they actually, under the direction of George Balanchine.
Wow.
Who is, for those who don't know, basically the founder of ballet in the United States, came from the Russian ballet heritage. And And then the year after, the spring after, they created a role in Balanchine's version of Don Quixote, specifically for me, because they didn't have anything for a small boy, and right. they made one so that they could bring me onto the stage. And that had a really profound effect on my youth, because here I was with literally no talent, being gushed over by, you know, the masters of this field.
Of American ballet.
Yes.
Yes.
And so that lasted for 3 years, at which point I wasn't growing fast enough. I couldn't do a pirouette. I was not a dancer.
Right. It was becoming evident that you could no longer be a stage prop.
That's correct. And so at the age of 10, I retired from the ballet. And
your sister went on for a few more years.
My sister went on for almost a decade, yeah. But the thing was that, as I said, that had a serious impact on my understanding of expectations of reward based on
performance. Or quality,
exactly.
Anyway.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Now, I mean, I was a good actor. And in fact, I did briefly engage in theater at that. You know, when I got out of the ballet, my parents put me into theater and karate, kind of as a, you know, taking the physical and the performance.
Right.
I had an interesting theatrical career, which included a couple of shows off Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And then things got kind of complicated, and so I left. I left that. But the thing was that I was much more inclined to act than I was to dance.
Right.
And I had always been inclined to sing. I've been told that I was humming This Old Man in my crib at 6 months old in order to get attention at 2 o'clock in the morning. Much to my father's...
Alternative to crying.
Right. Much to my father's chagrin. Well, it was the song that my mother sang to me, and I figured that was what you do in order to communicate.
Right.
And so I was...
And if it sends you off, it can bring her back.
Right, exactly. So the music part of it became more and more important to me. And as I began to assimilate the popular culture,
mm-hmm.
And realize, because my parents had grown up with, I mean, I had grown up in my parents' house with classical music and jazz.
Right.
But their popular music was very, very limited, mostly the traditional folk music and the union music,
which was in New York City in the 60s and 40s, 50s, 60s. Yeah, that exactly. was WQXR.
Yes. so we had a lot of classical and jazz in the house, but it wasn't until I got older and I started listening to my own radio stations mm-hmm. that I realized that there was this entire wealth of music. And I went through my Elvis Presley phase and my Beatles phase and as I got more and more into what it was that they were doing, what the poetry to the music was doing, uh-huh. and the message that was being communicated, it totally transformed my life. And now, to give some context,
yeah.
my father, who was the only child of immigrants who had come over during the Russian Revolution, my grandfather from Kiev, my grandmother from Poland, they came to the United States, built a life for themselves, had one child, and that was my father, who was a prodigy pianist, and then he also went to Stuyvesant High School in the 1930s and 40s.
Wow.
Actually the 1940s. So I was a legacy kid.
Yeah.
And the thing was that he, at about the age of 10, he sat me down and said, you know, son, the only jobs worth doing, the only jobs that you will have your own freedom with are to be either a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer. And so you are going to, you know, gear yourself up for that. Until the age of 18, I thought I was going to go to medical school. But in the meantime, I had started to play guitar and sing and was in a bunch of different bands. And by the time I ended up finishing high school, I was pretty certain that I didn't want to go to medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And I proceeded to get kicked out of the best colleges in the country, to paraphrase Charles Foster Kane, and because I had this sense of having to do this thing that I didn't really feel was me.
Right. Right. And it was your, and it was the legacy of your father, right, playing out through you.
Right. Like the legacy of my mother played out through my sister.
Yep. Yep.
But for her, she did the exact opposite. She started in the arts and she ended up as a lawyer. And I started out heading towards medical school and ended up spending about 10 years trying to reconcile what I was going to do with my life while making a mess running around trying to play music. And then what happened?
Yeah. Well, or actually, when did you become aware that this peripatetic life that wasn't working out was something you could change?
That is the $64,000 question. Yeah. I actually was sitting trying to figure out what I was going to do after having spent almost a decade wasting time. And my father said, well, look, I have this computer at the lab that I need to have some math done. And I liked math. Yeah. And I need some calculations done on data. How'd you like to come in and take
work
your
a
hand
little.
At it?
Yeah, work a little.
Yeah. Work in the dad's shop, as it were. And I said, you know, I literally had nothing better to do. And so I went and did that. And I was immediately taken by what I saw in computing.
This was the early mid 80s, I'm assuming?
It was the early 80s, yeah. It was, and this was a Digital Equipment Corporation's PDP-8, which was the size of a refrigerator and has less smarts in it than, you know, your dime store calculator now.
Right. And this was also the time in the economy, which was prior to 2007 and 8, when it was the hardest time for new students or young people to get jobs.
Oh, it was long before that.
In 1980, yes. That was the worst time prior to 2007, 2008 debacle.
I was part of that cohort, too. That's correct.
I worked as a gopher at a law firm.
Exactly. And so then he realized. At basically the same time, the microcomputer revolution was just beginning. And in 1981, my father brought home a very early version of the Apple II computer. And it changed my life. I taught myself to program. I learned the 6502 CPU's memory map by heart. I learned how to get inside computers, and I never looked back. My mom had met my father here at Cornell when he was teaching there. She had come out of an old Protestant family, and she was basically running away from that. Met him, got married 2 years later, and she spent probably 25 years as his research assistant. Got her PhD in psychology, he taught visual perception. I have to get that in because it's in the psych department at Cornell, right? Yeah. In Morrill Hall. Before it moved to
the Rusty.
Rusty, yeah. and so the thing is that she never felt like she had a direction of her own as she was going through this. Mm-hmm. And at some point there was too much friction. And to their esteemed credit, because they have now been married for 62 years.
Wow.
They worked through that tension. And my father basically said to my mother, well, what is it that you want to do?
Mm-hmm.
And she realized that the thing that she really loved about the work that she had been doing up until then in psychology was the work in film to create the stimuli that would be presented to his subjects during sure. experiments, right? Because his right. visual perception was, why do we see things the way we see things?
Right.
And so he would create stimuli with film. And that's what she liked to do. She liked the process of making the film, of editing the film. And so she went back to school and got a master's degree and then a PhD in film.
Uh-huh.
And ended up spending 30 years teaching film production at Brooklyn College. But the thing was that...
And
so,
I want to just footnote here.
Sure.
That I've had guests on this show from that generation who would be in their early 80s to
right.
mid-90s
yes.
at this point. And when they navigated, they all, to a couple, they had to navigate this male-female
right.
dynamic.
Oh, yes.
And when the men were able, and the women were able to say in no uncertain terms, something has to change, and the men were able to say, what are we going to do?
Sure.
That is the quality of interaction,
right.
I think, to a person
yes.
that they report who succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reporting on the ones who succeeded.
Yeah.
It's powerful.
It is.
Yeah.
And that's it's a discussion that, as a nation, we have had a hard time getting
yes.
ourselves around.
Yes.
And it's not just with men and women, but just across all of these tensions that we have with differences.
Yes.
What do we do?
I actually had not thought of it that way, but yes, that is a very accurate framing of it. Yes.
Yeah. So my father was a visual perception psychologist. My mother was a filmmaker. And I tried to decide what I wanted to do with my life, I realized that I really enjoyed television. And so I went to school for television production. And then I never used it because I ended up writing computer software for the rest of my career. But I've come back to it, and we can talk about that later. But why don't we go to another song?
Sure. Yeah. What would you like to play next?
Well, let's see. I think next up is a tune by Van Morrison, and this is Wild Night from his album Tupelo Honey.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and I'm your host, Eric Clay. And our guest on this hour is Jonathan Hochberg. So, Jonathan, well, continue. This is a great story.
Well, to wrap that piece of it up, I had spent about 10 years in New York City honing my computer programming skills, working as a freelance programmer. And this was at the time when programming as a thing really had started to just take off.
Was a big thing.
Yeah, it was a big thing. We're talking about the late 80s, early 90s. Yeah,
and people were incredibly valuable to
And it was ironic to me, or at least, it was ironic to me because I was self-taught, that I could bring this skill and actually perform and be, you know, rewarded for that performance. As something that I had done myself, as opposed to something which had been bestowed upon me by someone else.
You weren't in the ballet, you weren't in acting, you weren't doing musical performance, which requires a certain amount of training.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the musical performance.
It doesn't have to, but I mean, yeah.
I mean, especially the musical performance I was trying to do. But the point was, it wasn't based on degrees, you know, which is the thing that I had grown up with in my life.
Right.
It was of my own making.
Yep.
And so that really both was satisfying and sort of, you know, in the back of my head, perplexing and made me think a lot about where I was, what I was doing, how society reacted to me.
Right.
And you know, framing myself within this bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
And then New York City became like Cairo in the late 80s and the early 90s. It was really depressing. And I had a choice to make, and I made it, which was to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And I had always wanted to move back to Ithaca, but I didn't expect to be able to do it until I was retired because I didn't think that there was anything here for me in terms of, you know, livelihood.
Right.
I've learned since then that livelihood means a lot of different things, and there are a lot of different things to do. But at that point, I was, you know, I was pretty narrowly
focused.
You had
freed yourself of the blinders of higher education, but you hadn't freed yourself of the blinders of a career.
Right, just so. And so I was up here the summer of 1991, and oldest friends of our family, the people who had lived next door to us when I was growing up on Troy Road.
They were still here.
They've both passed.
No, they were still here, though, when you
came. They were still here, yes. Yeah. They were still here in 1991. And they knew that I was, like, trying to get out of New York. And they brought me this one-inch space ad from the classifieds of the Ithaca Journal saying somebody's looking for a programmer. And to make a long story short, it was the Seaboard Group at the airport. They needed a person with exactly my qualifications desperately because my predecessor in that position had left 2 weeks before the users group conference, where the primary complaint of the users was that there wasn't enough maintenance programming going on. And so I walked in the next Saturday, interviewed, walked out with the job in hand, and spent the next 2 weeks moving myself up from New York to Ithaca.
Wow. Wow.
And I've been working at the Seaboard ever since.
Wow.
Since 1991.
John Alexander.
Yes, exactly. Yes, yes. Although he no longer.
It was John Alexander's. It was his baby late 70s when I was an undergrad here in Cornell.
Exactly. Just so. And it was a very wild and woolly place to work. And it's become less so under various mutations into now being owned by the $4 billion Roper Industries. They own a lot of companies that have synergistic relationships.
Right. I mean, it would make sense.
Yes.
Now, how have you changed? And this is actually a much more pedestrian question than what you've gone through. But how have you changed in order to bend with that evolution of the business because it has gone through. I mean, I know it from far. Well, it's gone through huge change.
Yes, and you know, in a sense, it has paralleled my own maturation. In as much as when I got up here, I was in my early 30s, and I think I can safely say that I had the predilections of someone, you know, probably 20 years younger, because I was not as mature as my age, and I don't think that that was uncommon for men in my generation.
Not in your generation, not with the urban background, yeah. and the lack of focus, right. Lack of internal focus, yeah, that just you described.
And so I spent those early years in this, as I said, sort of Wild West entrepreneurial spirit that was Seaboard at that time,
yep.
Living fast and hard, which is what the Wild Nights song was about.
Right, right. I heard a story, John actually told it on himself, that he'd never met a piece of software that he wouldn't try,
yes.
Which meant that his systems kept crashing and yes. All the stuff. So.
Oh, yes. And he would go out and he would go to a customer, and the customer would say, well, we need this, that, and the other thing. And he said, oh, yeah, we've got that. And then he'd come back and he'd say, okay, build that.
Which is very entrepreneurial.
But. Yes. Oh, yeah. But it made exciting for excitement. And there were a lot of young adults working there. And we all partied very hard.
Yep.
And this is where the music comes back in, because when I first moved back to Ithaca, I had no idea that there was this thriving music scene. And in fact, it was just starting to hit its stride. That was the year that I moved back, was the first year of Grassroots Festival.
Yep.
And I missed that first year, but that following fall, one of my colleagues said to me, you've got to come out and listen to this band out in Trumansburg at this place called the Rongovian Embassy. And this was the end of the first iteration of the Rongovian Embassy. And you have to come listen to this band. And I went out there, and there was this absolute electricity in the crowd, and the Rongo has a relatively loose floor, at least it did then, and the crowd was moving and the floor was like a trampoline,
yep.
And the band was just frenetic, and that was the Horseflies in their original form,
yep.
And I was just blown away. I was thrilled. And I immediately immersed myself. I started going to the various venues, the old haunt, which is now DP Doe.
Right. Yeah.
And I got myself immersed in local music, and then I took over the house band at Seaboard. And originally, it was Seaboard makes food service software, among other things, and the house band was the food service equivalent of the Capitol Steps, if you can imagine. it's food service satire.
Yes.
And so the first couple of years, I said, okay, let's do food service satire, and then I took it over and said, okay, now we're going to be a cover band.
Right.
and we entertained at the users group conferences for about a decade, and then the users group conferences became less party and more business, and so we didn't do that anymore. But I took that same band and we played around town for a while. And so Seaboard, as I said, so the users group conferences became less and less parties and more about business.
Sure.
And the company became more and more about business and less and less about entrepreneurship.
Yep.
And about that same time, I was in an online chat room. On IRC, on Internet Relay Chat, and I met this woman, and she had a lot of the same interests as me, and we had some very interesting conversations, and I said, you know, we traded pictures, we, you know, talked on the phone a couple of times. I said, you know, we should meet. She said, okay. I said, all right, well, let's meet halfway, and she was in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And so we agreed to meet in Erie, Pennsylvania.
Right.
Drove out there, you know, expecting not much. But we immediately made a connection. And she actually followed me back to Ithaca and wrapped up her affairs in Michigan. And we got married 4 months later, and we've been married ever since.
Wow. Wow. Wow.
And so, you know, as the company became more and more mature, mm-hmm. being first sold to a holding company or an investment company,
sure, yeah.
And then finally sold to Roper, my life became more domestically mature.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a couple of kids. We had a couple of kids. I contributed to the manufacture of a couple of kids,
yeah.
and the raising of a couple of kids. So, you know, I have settled down, as it were. There were no more wild nights, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's really how I have adapted to the company's maturation, right. by following along with it.
Right. You know, your story of meeting and deciding so quickly to marry, that is far more common than, and for it to be a successful marriage in the sense that it's endured in positive ways.
Well, and I was also 41 and she was 38.
Yes.
And so we were.
But I have also heard this story from people who had what made it possible for you to embrace each other so quickly? What do you feel made it so clear to you that was the thing?
Actually, that's very interesting. So let me digress for just a moment.
Sure.
When I first started using computers, when my father brought that Apple II computer home, he brought a modem home because we needed to be able to connect to DARPA, to DARPANET.
Mm-hmm,
okay, and so
right.
This was before the
internet.
This
was the defense.
This was right.
Net,
this
yeah.
was a defense network, yeah. which was used by academics, this was even like before AOL, before
yeah. oh,
CompuServe.
Yeah. 10 years before
right.
AOL.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
Well, no, because the thing was that AOL and CompuServe came right on the heels of that. And in fact,
oh.
we started to use CompuServe when I was
okay.
using
yeah, yeah, yeah.
it. DARPA
right.
was around for before that.
Right, right.
But I was using DARPA for about 2 years. And then the professors all got CompuServe accounts and we started using CompuServe. And one of the things that immediately impressed me about that as a medium was that the anonymity of it allowed for pure intellectual interaction. You were typing words into
right.
this box and seeing words come back, and you didn't even have tone of voice, and you didn't have inflection, and you didn't have facial expression. You only had words.
So it's pure rationality.
That's right.
You got it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, you could only express yourself through the words.
Right. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So there was a power to that that was at once confining but
mm-hmm.
also liberating.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that, I observed that people developed relationships in that very quickly, partly because you would project your own
yes.
emotional state mm-hmm. onto the words that you were seeing,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
like reading a book. Nobody reads the same book
the same way. Absolutely. Yep.
And so I realized that there were pitfalls,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you
mm-hmm.
because I watched people get really deeply involved with other people for whom they had absolutely nothing in common, and you know that caused some really interesting
right
conflicts, but there was also the possibility, and I experienced it myself, for making a real connection really quickly,
right, and for learning how to express things in a way that would telegraph
yes.
Which allows you to use it more
right.
rationally.
Right.
It's a very
right.
tight.
Well, as you may have
yeah.
gathered, I'm into words.
Yeah, yeah.
I like
yeah.
words.
Yeah, yeah.
Words and me are friend.
Right. And yet you have a presence, a very strong presence and emotional quality, which, I mean, one of my old saws is we need to communicate. Is it intellectually accurate?
Mm-hmm.
Is it emotionally honest?
Mm-hmm.
And is it physically compelling to the senses?
Right.
If it flies on all three, it's probably true. If it only
right.
flies on one,
yeah.
you want to be wary of it.
Sure.
So there are lots of people who are good with words that can't make the other two fly.
Oh, yes.
And that is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, and what I found, you know, they talk about in my own chaplaincy training is when you learn to look away from the person you're visiting so you only hear the voice, then you get a different experience than when you look at them. And when you use these techniques so that you strip certain ways of knowing, then you have to become much more sensitive and much more intentional in communication.
Sure. It's like the difference between listening to Martin Luther King on the radio and, I don't know,
reading it or seeing it live. Sure. And I've known people who've done it all three ways.
Yeah, and I think that there's a... that there's a distinct lack of acknowledgement and coaching and training in those skills in modern life. Whereas at a time when there was not mass media, when people had to interact with each other, you know, face to face, there was a lot more of the generational transition of those skill sets.
Right, and the way I experienced, because I grew up kind of under the tutelage of people born in the 1880s and 1890s, because my father died and they kind of took me on. They were, to say they were old men for the most part, or old women at that point, but they were comfortable. They understood that a certain amount of drama is essential in communication.
Yes.
A certain amount of emotional freight is essential.
Yes.
But you also want to use words well, you know, and then you want to slow things down, but you want to know how to speed them up in case things need to move really fast. And that kind of, you know, I left that to come to Cornell in 1976, and this was a much more fast-paced and, in many ways, rigid environment communication-wise than what I grew up in.
Yeah,
and
you don't have the dynamic flexibility.
Decades to figure out what I had suffered.
Yeah.
It took me decades. Yeah. Anyway, where should we go to a music
piece?
Yes,
actually, because that does lead into what comes next. This is Paul Simon's American Tune.
Aha. Uh-huh. Very good.
Many's the time I've been mistaken, and many times confused. Yes, and I've often felt forsaken, and certainly misused. Oh, but I'm all right, I'm all right, just weary to my bones. Still, you don't expect to be bright and bon vivant so far away from home. So far away from home. I don't know a soul who's not been battered. I don't have a friend who feels at ease. I don't know a dream that's not been shattered or driven to its knees. Oh, but it's all right, it's all right, for we lived so well so long. Still, when I think of the road we're traveling on, I wonder what's gone wrong. I can't help it, I wonder what's gone wrong. And I dreamed I was dying. I dreamed that my soul rose unexpectedly. Looking back down at me, smiled reassuringly. And I dreamed I was flying. And high up above, my eyes could clearly see the Statue of Liberty sailing away to sea. And I dreamed I was flying. Oh, we come on the ship they call the Mayflower. We come on the ship that sails the moon. We come in the ages most uncertain hours and sing an American tune. Oh, and it's all right. can be forever blessed. Still, tomorrow's gonna be another working day, and I'm trying to get some rest. That's all I'm trying, to get some rest.
Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest is Jonathan Hochberg. So, Jonathan, you were talking about what made your life able to turn on a dime, in effect, to this committed relationship and a career in a firm from having wandering a kind of heavy entrepreneurial party kind of stuff. I'm sure it wasn't a dime, but there was something shifted.
It wasn't.
Something shifted over time, and the door opened in a different way.
Okay, so
how did you change? What in you changed?
You know, there's this thing in. So you know the TV show Sex and the City, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and there's this phrase in it that men are like taxi cabs, and you know you have to get them while their light is on. I had a long period where I didn't know myself.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I didn't know who I was.
Right.
And as I became more and more comfortable with, you know, finding out who I was, I realized that in order to make that real, to actually find out who I was,
right,
I needed to do that in the context of someone else.
Right.
I mean, I had gotten as far as I could on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And introspection only gets you so far.
Right. But how did you, I guess the question...
My light went on, as it were.
Yeah.
And I started, you know, actively looking for somebody to spend the rest of my life with. And, you know, up until that point, it had been more about excitement and, you know, the thrill and the romance of that and all of that, and less about building a relationship in order to get a better sense of inner self.
Right, right.
And when I made that transition, which was as Seaboard started to become more and more of a, you know, a formal company,
right,
that was when I, you know, started to make that transition.
And this was like 35 to 40.
It was actually 37. yeah late 30s.
And how would you, what would you say, because this is a, you know, some might say you're a particularly late bloomer, but for a lot of men, that's actually when it comes together, especially if you've had a kind of a searching 20s, or not necessarily searching, but an unfocused.
Ask the question again.
How what would you say to men and to their parents?
Oh my God!
About there is a time when you need to kind of figure out what this vessel is that you live in. You know,
Our society has undergone huge changes in the last century, and the last two centuries since the Industrial Revolution. Everything is very different.
Yeah.
And expectations are different. Opportunities are different.
Right.
Lifespans are longer, and the normal cycle of life has changed entirely from what it was in pre-industrial life.
Sure.
And I know all of that's like platitudes, but the thing is that we don't often really you know, think in those terms when we're thinking about things as prosaic as, well, you know, my kid is 20 and he doesn't know what to do with his life.
Well, yeah, give him another 20 years.
Right, exactly. And that's relevant because, you know, we have a lot more choices to make. Mm-hmm. Those choices are not always as transparent as they might seem.
Right.
And the ability to discern, you know, where those choices will lead you has become much more complicated.
Right. And the illusion that we need to know where they're going to lead, as opposed to just trust, have the hope and the trust, the confidence.
Right.
Well, that we can live.
And also the ability to say, okay, I'm going to try this and see how it plays out.
And that's, but that is confidence.
Yeah.
That is confidence, because I can change what I set out to do. If I can't, I can't set out because I'm locked.
Sure. Sure. And I you know, I think there's some, I mean, you can enter into that. You can go on that path with confidence,
right?
Or you can go on that path scared stiff.
Absolutely, and it doesn't, on some level, make any difference
as long
as you go.
Exactly, that's right, that's right. And so it is a question of overcoming the reluctance to make change.
Right, right, right. I usually end with a question. That, yes, I usually end with a question. We're really tight for time, especially to get into last music. What do you do to take note of what's going on in yourself, physically, emotionally, intellectually, to kind of restore yourself?
Well, I find that when I am getting ahead of myself, when I find when I'm trying to do too much at once,
right,
and when I can't get the things done because I've got too much on my
right.
plate, I generally go and retreat into music. And I have an annual date out in Trumansburg every year that is sort of like a pilgrimage for me at the Grassroots Festival, which is, you know, an anticipated thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then I also have a side career with videoing music performance here in Ithaca and in the area, which allows me to step out of my normal routine and get some cleansing, as it were.
Yeah. Yeah. And music is so great because it can be intellectual, emotional, and physical all at the same time.
And, you know, I have this thing about the vibration and its relevance to physics and our state in the world, but we'll have to save that for another time.
Yeah.
So, all right.
Jonathan, it's been great.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Eric.
What are we going
let's
to
Let's go
next?
Out with the last song on that list there.
So it's
actually,
number five?
Four. Well, actually, what's next up there?
Well, whatever. Okay,
I think.
Let me just see if I can.
Yeah, go here. To. Yeah, okay. That's great. That's the Beatles Here, There, and Everywhere,
right.
Which is a beautiful song and which I dedicate to my wife.
Here we go. Watching them.